I'm supposed to lecture to you this morning on theory and history, and the book I'd like to recommend that everyone read is a book by Mises called Theory and History. That's great. This came out in 1957. This is the fourth of Mises' four major books. You know, we have Theory of Money and Credit, which originally came out in German 1912. Then Socialism, which came out in 1922, Human Action, 1949, and Theory and History, 1957. This is probably the least read of Mises' four most important books, but it's also the easiest to read. It's a very important book. Friedrich Hayek thought very highly of this book. I know that because he told me that himself. The reason I mention this is not only to tell you that Hayek thought it was a good book, but so I can point out that I knew Hayek. He was my teacher. Never hurts to put that in. All right, now when we talk about philosophy of history, the history is ambiguous. We can mean two different things, and I'll be devoting some time to each of these. By history, we can mean the process of writing history. What are the philosophical problems? What are the problems involved in writing history? What does it mean, in particular, to explain a historical event? So what we're concerned with in this part of philosophy of history is history is the, sort of the activity of the historian. And then the other sense of history are the actual events that have taken place in the past. Here, the questions on philosophy of history would be questions such as, is there some kind of universal story or pattern that we can find in history other than the histories of particular countries or people or civilization? Are there philosophical general stories we can tell about what actually happened in history? So see the distinction. The first area is concerned with what the historian is doing. The other part is what happens in history, what happened in history. So these are the two broad divisions. I don't mean in any way to suggest the two aren't connected with each other, but you see there are these two separate divisions. Now, I wanted to start with the problems facing the historian, the activity of writing history, and what, in particular, Mises has to say about this. Now, when we study things in the physical sciences, how do we do that? Well, basically, there's a lot of theoretical reasoning going on in physics. We use mathematics and argument, but in the physical sciences, what we do is really dependent on observation of what goes on in the world. Of course, we can have experiments where we try to have control of the observation. We don't just see things as they happen. We try to control what happens, but this is just really another type of observation. We're really dependent on sensory observation. We're seeing, suppose we're studying physics, we have to do all sorts of experiments with some of them, like with the nuclear accelerators, and we do various things with astronomy. We're looking at the sky and seeing various things. So we're seeing various physical events, we're observing what's happening. Now, in history, we have another way of studying things. We're not just dependent on observation of what goes on in the senses. Of course, in history, we can't see what happened in the past events. It isn't strictly correct to say, incidentally, we can't see into the past because according to some theories of perception, we're always seeing the past. We never see the present since it takes light waves at least some time to reach us. So we're never actually, at least if you accept this view of perception, we're never actually seeing the immediate present. We're always seeing the past, but certainly we can't directly observe, say, Caesar's crossing the Rubicon in 55 BC. I was almost going to say 44 BC, but of course that was the date he was assassinated. Hayek once made the same mistake, incidentally. Yes, it was. I was quite surprised. You know, I remember it very well. It was in, when I took that class from him in 1969. He made that mistake. I was shocked. I almost walked out of the room in protest, but I didn't. So, as I say, we can't observe into the past, but we're not dependent, as I say, on external observation. Remember from your studying praxeology, if you remember when Hans Hoppe spoke about this in other lectures, I gave a talk yesterday. We know we act, each of us acts, is the basic axiom of praxeology, human beings act. So we know what it is to act, as it were, from the inside, since each of us acts. So we, according to Mises, we can apply this knowledge that we have, what it is to act, to understanding history. We're not dependent on just looking at certain documents or trying to reconstruct certain archaeological sites. We can actually try to imagine what it is, what various historical actors have done in the past. And we do this because we ourselves are actors, so we know what it is to act. Now, in doing this, we're really taking kind of the principle I mentioned in my lecture last time. We're there. I also mentioned this principle, incidentally, for those of you who weren't at the lecture. I mentioned this principle called methodological singularism. Where, remember, methodological singularism is a basic principle Mises uses in economics, is that we try to consider the form of any particular action. We take any action we want and say, what are the characteristic features that make this an action? Well, here in history, we're not doing that. We're not disregarding the content of the action. We're not concerned with the form of all action. We're concerned with what happens in a particular action. So, unlike praxeology, we're not stating necessary relationships. We're not trying to come up with necessary features of all actions. We're dealing with contingent matters, what happened at a particular time, a particular action. We're trying to understand what certain historical actors do. And we're also making use of another principle of praxeology, methodological individualism, because we're concerned with how particular individuals have acted. There are some approaches to history, such as Marxism, about which I'll be talking later, that don't stress individual action. They talk about large-scale historical movements, say the class struggle or development of the forces of production. But in the Misesian approach, we're primarily concerned with how individuals act, and we're trying to understand how these individuals have acted in the past. Now, how do we do this? I've said, since we ourselves are actors, we can understand how particular individuals have acted. How do we do this? Well, here Mises developed and made use of a notion that was quite prominent among certain 19th century historians, in particular, and also some 20th century historians. I want to mention two names. First, Wilhelm Dilthey. And I would usually make this so it's read it, but too high technology for me. So what Dilthey talked about, a concept Mises used called Verstehen, and this is, means a kind of understanding. So what is the nature of this understanding? It's not understanding, say, by a general theory, but it's understanding something by understanding the motives of a particular actor. Sort of what we do in Verstehen is we say, what are the, suppose we have some, let's take again, Caesar's crossing the Rubicon in 55 BC. We say, what are the motives Caesar had in deciding to cross the Rubicon? We can understand this because we ourselves act from particular motives. So we try to come up, we look at various documents. They say there's one document where Caesar says, you know, he had gotten an order from the Senate not to cross the river. So he said something like, well, if I obey this order, then this will, my dignitas, which means sort of a sense of honor, will go down. But he says, if I cross the river, then everybody's going to be upset or unhappy. So he says, all right, then what do we do? Well, then we cross the river. You know, much better to make everybody unhappy than to have his sense of dignitas upset. So here, if we want to understand what Caesar did, we say, well, we try to imagine ourselves, we say, if I had the motives that Caesar did, what would I have done in a particular this particular situation? And this is how we understand what would happen. Or again, let's take another case. There are all sorts of examples one could get. After the famous Munich conference, which was on September 29th and 30th, 1938, where the British and French agreed to surrender the Sudetenland, Czechoslovakia, to Hitler, then British policy became much tougher toward Germany in March, beginning October 38, particularly March 39, after the Germans took over Bohemia as a protectorate. So we could ask, why did the British Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain, the Foreign Secretary Lord Halifax, decide to take a stronger line? Why did they abandon the appeasement policy they had pursued at Munich conference? So we can try to get from the documents what are the motives they had. And then we again ask ourselves, say, if we had these particular motives, how would we have acted? By doing that, we can come to some understanding of how they acted in this particular situation. So what we're doing is we're trying to, in Verstehen, we're trying to reconstruct the motives of a particular historical actors. And in that way, we grasp what they're doing. Now, the other person I wanted to mention who kind of continued Dilthey's tradition of Verstehen also influenced Mises somewhat. Mises liked him very much. He praised this man for his knowledge of economics with R.G. Collingwood. That one's readable also. Now, Collingwood was a British philosopher and historian. It was also, he wrote on history of Roman Britain, and he was an archaeologist also. He was a professor of philosophy at Oxford. And he had the view that the historian is similar to what I've mentioned already. The historian is rethinking the thoughts of the actor. So he said, now this is a rather unusual view, which I don't think Mises held, that when the historian does this, he's really having exact, if he's been correct in his reconstruction, he's having exactly the same thoughts as the historical actor. So by that, he didn't just mean sort of thoughts with the same characteristics, like supposing, say, I came up with the correct explanation of why Lord Halifax in October 1938 had a seized control of British foreign policy from Neville Chamberlain. Suppose I come up with the correct explanation. According to Collingwood, I wouldn't just be having the similar thoughts to Halifax. It would be exactly the same thoughts. So I would be, the according to Collingwood's peculiar view, the thoughts in Halifax's mind really don't take place at a particular at this particular time in the past, only at this particular time in the past. They're really contemporary with me. So he's kind of applying the statement by a famous Italian philosopher, Croce, all history is contemporary history, to mean that when you reconstruct the thoughts, you're actually undergoing the history yourself. They say this is a view that Mises didn't continue, I think, probably wisely. Seems kind of an odd metaphysical view. Now, I should say, while we're on the subject of odd metaphysical views, one of my specialties, there are some suggestions that Mises has when he's talking about historical explanation of a view that I don't think is essential to what he says about Verstehen. It's kind of a view when he's saying that, he sometimes says the historian has an intuitive grasp of what's happening, or in the what he seems to be thinking here is something like this. Suppose I talk about something in concepts, like I'm talking about this thing here, whatever it is. I have no idea, but I could describe it in various ways. I could apply certain concepts to it. So whenever I describe it, something in a certain way, it's at least in principle that there could be more than one of them, because I've said, say, this is a gray object. Well, there can be all sorts of other gray objects. So in this view, if I wanted to speak about the individuality of an event, sort of the thisness, as Duns Scotus, the great medieval philosopher called it, I couldn't do this in terms of any concepts. So if I want to talk about the individuality of an event, I have to grasp it in some sort of non-conceptual, intuitive way. Now, as I say, I don't think this view is essential to Verstehen, because you can certainly have descriptions of something in concepts that, although perhaps in principle there could be many instances, there's in fact just one instance of them. So I don't really think this notion of an intuitive grasp of something without concepts is really going to get you very far. But Mises sometimes uses, and he was influenced to some extent by the French philosopher Henri Bergson, who was a very big name in philosophy around in the early 20th century. He isn't studied too much now. Some of the continental philosophers still studying, but he was, a very big name. And Mises, he emphasizes non-conceptual, intuitive grasp of things, although not especially applied to history. So I think Mises was to some extent influenced by him. But it's not essential to the notion of Verstehen as Mises practices. All that we have to really grasp is that it's a notion, not intuitive, non-conceptual knowledge, but knowledge of historical actors' decisions by trying to reconstruct his motives. Now, in doing this reconstruction, Mises emphasizes ideal types, which was made famous by the great sociologist also a friend of Mises, Max Weber. An ideal type, as Mises describes it, is something like this. We take a particular concept, like such as an entrepreneur, and we impute to an entrepreneur particular motives. Say we say an entrepreneur is alert to profit opportunities. So we have various ideal types where we've attributed motives to historical act types, such as entrepreneur or capitalist. We say, well, what motives? We just emphasize a particular motive. Then we try to see, do these ideal types apply to particular actors in history? So this can very often be of use to us, this method of ideal types. Now, the method that Mises describes of Verstehen hasn't taken the field unopposed there. People say, no, this isn't the right way to do things. This isn't the way the historian should proceed. And I want to mention the main alternative to this, which for those of you who heard Hans's lecture, you'll probably not be surprised to hear that the main opposition to this notion of Verstehen came from the logical positivists. They were the ones who, remember, were opposed to Mises in Method and Economics, and they also didn't like this notion of Verstehen that these 19th century historians like Dilthey and others, such as Wilhelm Windelband and Heinrich Rickert, who continued in the 20th century, they didn't like these, or I shouldn't say they didn't, even if they should say they didn't like them, but this method, at least they opposed it, whether they liked it or not, they probably didn't like it either. But they had a different view, and particularly important here is an article by Karl Hempel, who was a member of the Vienna Circle, kind of when he was a young man, and then was a professor at Princeton for many years, a professor of philosophy. He had an article in 1942 in Journal of Philosophy called The Function of General Laws in History. Now, what he said, you'll see, is a contrast to what I've been mentioning so far, which is that the historian is trying to reconstruct what particular actors have done, the motives of particular actors. What he said is, no, when a historian is explaining a particular event, what he's trying to do is to bring that event under a general law. And so one basic principle of logical positivists is that explanation is the same in the physical sciences as it is in history or social sciences. So remember I was saying at the beginning, Mises says, well, because we act ourselves, we have a different way of understanding historical events than we do of physical events. We're not just dependent on external observation. We don't just have to watch how particular physical bodies move. We ourselves are actors, so we can understand these actions from the inside. Hempel and the other positivists said, no, this isn't right. All explanation has the same form. And what is this form? Well, according to him, when you explain a physical event, you have a general law, and then you have certain initial conditions, and this enables you to explain what's happened. For example, suppose I want to try to calculate what a particular force that a body is displaying. So what I have the basic formula, say force equals mass times acceleration, I think. So then that's the general law. Then I have the initial conditions, which are the particular mass and acceleration I've started with. And by applying this general law that enables me to know the force in this particular case I'm interested in. So what I've done is, the explanation is dependent on a general law that's applied to certain particular conditions. And this method of explanation, it's called the deductive nomological theory, affectionately the DN model of explanation. The affectionately was supposed to be a joke, but you don't have to laugh. It would be appreciated. All right. So Hempel, in his article, said, you know, this method, this DN method, it should be, is what you use in history also. It's sometimes in history, people call it, following the Canadian philosopher W.H. Drey, who was a critic of Hempel, the covering law model. I think it's a very good name for it because you're saying the historical event is, you're trying to explain the event by bringing it under a law that covers it. So how would the that someone who accepts this view, apply it? Well, supposing you're trying to apply it to the event, one of the events I mentioned before, Caesar's crossing the Rubicon. Well, you might, the historian might say, well, we have a general law that if people, say, are of a certain psychological disposition, such as having a very sensitive notion of dignity, or faced with certain orders, they'll tend to disobey those orders. So this is the, you see, what the positivist view would be, instead of trying to reconstruct the motives of a particular person, Julius Caesar, we're trying to come up with a general law that Caesar's particular action illustrates or is an example of. Now, you can see the problem with this view is, which I think is a rather difficult one to overcome, we really don't have laws of this kind. So if positivists are right, we really couldn't come up with historical explanations at all. We don't, unlike physics or chemistry, we just don't have general laws of that kind. So we really are... This, what they're suggesting, really doesn't help us very much. Now, I should mention, what was their criticism of Fichte, and why did they say this wasn't acceptable? Well, according to the positivists, this notion, kind of trying to reconstruct the motives by understanding a particular action, might be all right for as a way of generating a hypothesis. Well, I said, well, because of what I've given you, I imagine that Caesar's reason for crossing the Rubicon was that he thought that if obeying the Senate would offend his sense of dignity, it would affect his honor, so he's going to cross the river. I could say that, but I don't have, the question would then be, what is the evidence for this? And they say, well, in order, it's not enough just to come up with some kind of imaginative reconstruction of somebody's motives. You have to have evidence for this. But I think just what the proponents of the other view, what Mises would say, is this is all there is. There is no further process of testing the hypothesis by experimental or observational evidence. This is, if we don't, we're not satisfied with this, then we don't have anything. So now, in addition to Verstehen, I want to talk now about another way that Mises gives that the Austrian theory can be of use to the historian. And this is the use of certain conclusions in praxeology that we can apply to history. And by knowing economic theory, this will enable us, in some cases, to understand historical events in a different way, and I think a better way, from historians who don't know the praxeological theory. Now, one example of this we can find in this understanding the Industrial Revolution. You can find in Human Action, Mises has a very good a few pages on Industrial Revolution in the Scholar's Edition. I think it's around page 613 to 619. Everybody should read this. It's very good pages. So what Mises says, you see, one of the standard views of the Industrial Revolution was very popular, especially in the 1930s, kind of a view that the Industrial Revolution really worsened conditions for the working class. People were really having to work in William Blake called the dark satanic mills, although there's some question whether by dark satanic mills he actually meant industrial factories. Some people think he meant churches. But there's actually about five different interpretations of what Blake meant, but that's a digression. But anyway, so people have this view that the factory workers were really in very bad conditions, and some of the descriptions of the conditions they worked in do sound very bad. But we know from economic theory that capitalism is the most productive economic system. Really, interventions in the market always fail to achieve their purpose. So we would suspect from economic theory that this can't be the real story. And in fact, if we know this, we'll tend to look at the evidence, historical evidence, in a different way. We'll be concerned, especially with such facts as that the population in England was rising at the time. And we wonder, would without the capitalist enterprises, without these new factories, would the workers have been able to live at all? It isn't that they would have lived in some kind of Arcadian rural conditions of bliss, but they would have had an even worse position without industrial development. So see here, if the knowledge of the economic theory helps us explain the events, we can have another example of this. Another one Mises gives is in trying to understand the fall of the Roman Empire. And Mises applies economic theory here. He quotes the great Russian social historian of the Roman Empire, Michael Rostovtsev, and he says that it wasn't the barbarian invasions that destroyed Rome. He says it was the fact that interventionist measures in the economy, such as price control and debasement of the currency, weakened the economy to such an extent that there was very little, at any rate, trade going on. There was no economic exchange. So the economy had become reduced to really self-subsistent farming. And it was so weakened to such an extent that the barbarian invasions were able to succeed. And you can find Mises has just a very brief discussion of Human Action of this, I think it's around 761, 762. That's also worth looking at. I'm sure there's. So that's, as I say, another example. So you know the economic theory and you apply it to the particular historical event. And just one last example. This is one you remember from Bob Murphy's lecture in the one in the evening. You know, say you're trying to explain the origins of the 1929 depression. Well, you have a basic difference, say, between the Austrian theory of the business cycle. You remember is that bank credit expansion will induce lower the monetary rate of interest below the natural rate of interest, which is determined by time preference. So this will encourage businessmen to expand the structure of production. And then when the credit expansion stops, then they'll find that these businesses can't be sustained. So they have to be liquidated. And that's the depression. That's the process of liquidation, is the depression. So if you take this theory, then you have it's completely different from the monetarist view, which says that the depression came about, 1929 depression came about, made much more severe because the Federal Reserve contracted the money supply. So if you accept the Austrian view, then you'll be looking at the data in a different way. You'll be stressing, say, the expansion of credit by the Federal Reserve in 1926 rather than the credit contraction, where the credit contraction will be viewed as much more a secondary phenomenon. So you see here how knowledge of praxeology will affect how the historian is going to investigate particular historical events. Now, what I've so far been talking about is problems of the historian's activity, sort of what is involved in explaining a historical event. How do we reconstruct the historical actor's motives, or what theories can we use to understand from praxeology? What theories can the historian use to understand particular events? But in the rest of the time, I want to talk about the other part of philosophy of history that I mentioned, which is the views that the process of history displays a certain pattern, where in addition to, say, histories of the United States or history of Europe or biographies of particular of Caesar or Abraham Lincoln, we can ask, is there a pattern to history overall? Now, Mises was concerned with these theories because most of the theories are inconsistent with economics as he practices it. So he was very interested in refuting most of these theories. And the one I want to talk about in particular is Marxism, which at one time was very influential. Since the collapse of communism, it's not as strong as it used to be, although I imagine English departments in most universities haven't heard about the collapse of Marxism. So I want to give Mises in Theory and History gives a very penetrating criticism of Marxism, so I want to give some account of what he says here. Now, Marx, of course, the great figures here, of course, are Marx and Engels. Mises, in his interpretation of Marx, follows the various ways of taking Marx's theory of history. But Mises follows especially a view, the interpretation by the great Russian Marxist. He was a leader of the Social Democratic, the Mensheviks, which was one branch of the Russian Social Democratic Labor Party, George Plekhanov. He had a famous book called The Development of the Monist Conception of History, which I think came out in 1891, I think. I think this is right. Okay, now, I should mention also, there's a very good book by probably the best Marxist philosopher today is G.A. Cohen, and he has a book called Karl Marx's Theory of History of Defense, and he follows Plekhanov's interpretation also. So Mises is certainly in a good company, isn't just coming up with kind of an odd interpretation. Marx's kind of very standard view. Cohen's book is very much worth reading if you're interested in Marx's. He's a very good philosopher, even if he thinks some of my jokes go too far, which he does. I can't forgive him for that. All right, so according to Marx, the key fact in all of world history is that the forces of production have a constant tendency to develop. By forces of production, he meant roughly the technology available to a particular society. So there's a constant tendency in history for technology to grow, say in the, from the Stone Age, or we progressed and we have hand tools, and then we have various steam engines. We have all sorts of much more advanced technology now. So we see throughout history, there's a linear trend. Technology is developing. Now, at each stage in the development of the forces of production, there's a particular economic system that's best suited to develop the forces of production. So I'll put this down, forces. The economic and social system is called the relations of production. So according to Marx, we have each particular historical period, there's a certain type of relations of production that will best develop force of production. Say in the ancient world, slavery was the system that best developed the force of production. In the Middle Ages, it was feudalism. In the world in which time at which he wrote, in the 19th century, it was capitalism. He thought in future it would be socialism would be the best way to develop the force of production. That would be the final system, at least. There would be stages of socialism. Once you got to socialism, that's it. That's the final stage. So the basic idea is you explain what the social and economic system is, the relation of production, by saying what would best at the time develop the forces of production, the technology. Now, supposing a particular economic system best develops the forces of production at a given time, then as the forces continue to grow, it won't be the case anymore that that social system is going to develop the force of production the best. As Marx says, it'll when you talk about capitalism, it'll become a fetter, a chain on the development of force of production. So what will happen then, it'll be overthrown, because in each type of relations of production, before you get to socialism, you have conflicting classes. So the classes that the kind of the class that was oppressed by the previous social system will overthrow it when it at that point at which the what used to be the system that was best suited to develop a force of production ceases to be that and becomes a drag on the force of production, and then will be replaced by a new system. So this is, I'm very oversimplifying, kind of the basic thrust of Marxism. Now, Mises was concerned with this, because if this is right, remember, he thinks that certain laws of economics apply universally, with conclusions of praxeology don't vary by according to particular historical periods. It isn't that there's one set of laws that apply during the Middle Ages, there's another set of law applies in the 19th century, another set of laws for the ancient world. They're the laws of praxeology, theorems of praxeology, hold universally. So he needs to respond to this system because it's a challenge to praxeology. Now, gives some, I think, very fundamental criticisms of Marxism. One is, what is involved when we say that the forces of production have a constant tendency to develop? Marx seems to be taking forces of production as if it's some kind of independent entity, some kind of force, something apart, completely apart from individuals, that just has a constant tendency to grow. But Mises points out, and here he's making use, remember, of the fundamental principle of praxeology, methodological individualism, only individuals act. He said, well, if technology develops, this comes about because particular people have come up with new ideas. It isn't that there's some sort of independent force called technology or forces of production that's developing by itself, whether people want it to or not. It's particular people have come up with these new innovations. And if they don't come up with them, then technology isn't going to develop. Now, we can have another criticism is, why is it the case, as Marx thinks, that, say, in the ancient world, slavery is the best system to develop the force of production. In the Middle Ages, feudalism is, with serfdom, is the best system. We know from praxeology that free enterprise is always the most efficient system. We know this because we see how particular interventions in the free market will fail to achieve the purpose of the ones who try to institute them. So the free enterprise is always the most productive system. So Marx's assumption that it's only in the 19th century that capitalism becomes the most productive system is not correct. He doesn't give any reason to think that in previous periods these particular systems would best develop the force of production. Now, there's an interesting way we could actually develop, if you accepted the Marxist view, you could kind of develop a Marxist argument for capitalism, which would go somewhat like this. Marx, remember, thought that capitalism would be replaced by socialism because he said that capitalism would no longer develop the force of production in the best possible way. It would become a drag on the force of production. Then we would need to replace it by socialism. But supposing one accepts, certainly one should, Mises' economic calculation argument that shows that socialism, far from being the most productive system, couldn't work at all. We wouldn't be able to know how the means of production could be employed efficiently under socialism, since we wouldn't have monetary calculation. We wouldn't know, say, whether moving a resource from one type of production to another type would increase the efficiency or decrease the efficiency of the system, wouldn't be able to calculate. So what happens if we say Mises is right that socialism leads to economic chaos? Then we would have capitalism is the most productive system. So we would have a Marxist argument that the force of production have developed to such a point that capitalism is the required system, and that this would just remain true indefinitely. And in fact, there are some Marxists who hold this view. There was a professor, Indian economist, Meghnad Desai, who wrote a book arguing that Marxists should really support capitalism, at least for the indefinite future, simply because it was the most productive system and socialism, at least for a long time, wouldn't work. And in fact, the Mensheviks, who were, remember, the group in the Russian Social Democratic Labor Party, opposed a socialist revolution in Russia. They said you need to develop capitalism first until it becomes socialism can only come about when capitalism has reached its fullest possibilities and no longer develops the force of production, greatest extent any system can. And if Mises is right, that future time will never come about. So Marxists who took that part of the theory seriously would then end up being supporters of capitalism. Now, the last criticism that Mises makes of Marxism that I want to mention is, remember, in Human Action, I don't know, probably because I've been skipping most of the lectures, whether people have discussed Mises' criticism, what he calls polylogism. Has that come up in your lectures, polylogism? Well, good. So I like to come up with new material. So what polylogism is the view that it's not the case that everyone always follows the same logic. Different groups or races have different logics. Mises is very much opposed to this view. And at least some varieties of Marxism accept this. They say that, say, capitalists, the bourgeoisie, think in a different way from the proletariat. So there's kind of a proletarian logic that's opposed to capitalist logic. And to Mises, this view doesn't really make any sense. He said, well, if it's claimed that different groups use different logic, for one thing, he'd like to see what these logics are. What are the different rules that are alleged that the proletariat and the bourgeoisie are following? They're never specified. It's just usually people who say that are just giving this as a reason that they say they don't have to refute the criticisms that the economists have made of Marxism, because they say, well, these economists are just members of the bourgeoisie. They're trying to advance their own class interests. They're unable to understand the logic of the working class, so they don't really need to refute them. So it's just really a device to avoid criticism. So I think we just have a very few minutes left. Now, I think I could talk about another very definitely non-Marxist theorist, Oswald Spengler, and Mises' criticisms of him. But I think rather than doing that, wouldn't be fair to cram Spengler into 3 or 4 minutes. I'll just leave the rest of the time for any questions, objections. Anyone have anything? Yeah.
What would Mises or a praxeologist say to a force like, you know, you brought up Marxist theory about production being the sort of movement of history. Mm-hmm. What about something like Hegel's Geist?
Oh, well, Mises does discuss that, and he takes the view that similar problem, the one I mentioned with the force of production. He says Hegel takes this as some sort of entity apart from individuals. So he says this can be ruled out on grounds of methodological individualism. And I should say there are people who take Hegel in a different way, you know, that don't take him as kind of Weltgeist, as some kind of entity acting apart from individuals. But that was the way Mises took him. It's common interpretation. Well, I think that Kant in his essay is actually fairly compatible with what the Austrians are saying, because what he stresses kind of this kind of a result that even when you have nations clashing, the result will be kind of universal peace eventually. So it's kind of a more of an emergence of a spontaneous order. That it's very similar to certain things Hayek has said. In fact, Hayek was influenced by Kant. I remember he thought very highly of Kant in that respect. So I think Kant is really talking about effects of particular individuals' actions. So I don't think he's inconsistent with anything that praxeology is saying, but Mises wouldn't be committed to accepting he was right. He thought, I mean, it wouldn't be inconsistent. You had one? See, I think one. This will be the last one.
Would Mises say there's nothing to the idea that your environment
is not at all? Oh, no, I don't think Mises would dismiss environmental influences, but he would just say they operate through individual actions. It isn't that we say there are particular laws because, say, it's a hot climate, does people will act in a certain way. I remember there was a popular writer in the 30s, Ellsworth Huntington, who had a theory of climate. And of course, earlier writers like Jean Baudin in the 16th century, and Montesquieu later on had whole theories where climate is determining what happens. But this applies only according to Mises, these variables would be relevant only in through how they affect individual actors. You know, you wouldn't be able just to say, because the environment is such, the economic system will be such, you have to take account of the
more. Also, you could say the content of people's thoughts, but not the structure, logical structure.
Oh, yeah, yes. And also, well, I think it's about finishing. Thanks very much.